the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 246. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. Oh, do we have so much to talk about. There's always so much every episode. We're never, someday it would be nice. One time out of 246 episodes, Andrew, it'd be nice to get to like 40 minutes and be like, guess we're...
How do we pad this one out?
Yeah, guess we're out of stuff. I don't think that will ever happen. we've got so much we're going to talk about. We got a nice MAGA hatter question. That's always fun. And we're going to talk Alex Jones, because this Sandy Hook lawsuit seems to be going forward, which I think is good news, because what he has done along those lines is disgusting. Andrew, let me know how much I can say without running afoul of defamation, but whatever, everything Alex Jones did with the Sandy Hook, truther kind of gimmick he was doing is disgusting and horrifying, and I do hope that there are legal consequences for it, but that's just me. So we're going to hear Andrew's breakdown, and I'm seeing here if time, we'll do a little mountain yodeling. I hope that there's time, because we haven't yodeled, and I promised yodels last week, so we'll hopefully get to that.
If not, remember, I am being held hostage here at Opening Arguments. I wanted to yodel. I put it on the whiteboard, so direct all of your complaints at SiriusPod.
If you wanted to yodel so badly, you know, it's like the show me your budget and I'll tell you what you care about. Show me the number of bullet points you have under Alex Jones, and I'll show you how much you wanted to yodel. I'll show you what you value. Do you value yodeling, or do you value talking about the Alex Jones lawsuit? There's like 70 bullet points, which is that's usually a 3-hour episode. So we'll see.
I'm just gonna say if Brian does not cut you saying show me your budget, then I'm gonna be truly, truly disappointed, because that's a great one for the blackmail.
Seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to say. I don't really know what you're talking about, but let's get right to it so that we're not wasting any more time. Of course, Andrew's on Naked Mormonism 138. We told you about that last week, but definitely check it out. Bryce Blankenagel's fantastic show. So check Andrew out over there. But with that said, let's get to our listener question.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
We've got a MAGA hatter trolling the libs and actually pledging to the show. This is somebody I've argued with on Twitter historically forever, going back. I probably muted or blocked them by now, but they decided to pledge the show, which, all right, fine. But they asked on our Patreon page, you guys frequently blame Jill Stein for Hillary's election loss, but seemingly ignore that there were three times as many Gary Johnson voters as Stein voters, including in the crucial swing states. If both spoiler candidates were eliminated from ballots, Trump would still have won. And for my part, I do not believe we've ever blamed Jill Stein for Hillary's loss. I know I haven't because early on, I think, like right as the election, you know, right after the election, before we had final numbers, I think it's possible that we said some things that could be construed as, you know, oh, these third party candidates spoiled the election. But I know, I am positive that once the final numbers were in, we talked about that fact, or at least mentioned the fact that it's not. Yeah, if every Jill Stein voter went for Hillary, it wouldn't have changed the election. I'm pretty confident. You can go back and listen to all 246 episodes, but I'm pretty confident we did address that at some point. But you know, to be fair to this MAGA hatter, it's a lot of content, so I don't really blame him if he only heard the times maybe when the final numbers weren't in or something like that. So that's what I had to say. What say you to this?
Oh, I love this question so much. Well, it's technically a statement, not a question, but I love the statement so much because to the extent that it represents an honest interpretation of what I've said on the show, it lets me clarify that. So boy, let's go. Let's delve into all of this. Number one, I don't care to assess blame for the 2016 election, right? Like that's if you're writing an
alternate, I blame the voters.
Yeah, if you're doing an alternate history or look, the blame, right, from a moral perspective lies with people who voted for Donald Trump. The blame from a strategic perspective, as I've long said, rests with the Hillary Clinton campaign, and it rests in a number of ways, right? Like number one, it should not have fallen to opening arguments to have been the only source for the real information on her damned emails. That's episode 13, one of my favorites, one of the ones I'm most proud of.
So we blame the media as well.
Yeah, you always neutralize the biggest attack on you. When you fail to do that, like John Kerry and the Swift boats, you lose. So that was sort of number one. Number two, the Hillary Clinton campaign failed to really coalesce on a single coherent theme against Donald Trump. We talked about this on the show, right? That like the ads of Donald Trump hires contractors, stiffs them, and you know, it just that writes itself. And the fact that those ads ran a couple of times, but were not like the core thesis, right? The core thesis should have been, you have a guy who lives in a gold plated house who pretends like he's a fan of the little guy, and every little guy he's ever come across, he's stiffed in his entire life. Right. That's not a hard argument to make. And the Hillary Clinton campaign didn't make it. And number three, like the lack of data. Right. Like I've described how my son and I did phone banking for Hillary Clinton. And we called people in Florida, Arizona and Georgia, I believe. Like we didn't call anybody in Pennsylvania. We didn't call anybody in Wisconsin. We didn't call anybody in Michigan. They didn't seem to think like, yes, they knew Pennsylvania was an issue, but like they never visited Michigan. They never visited Wisconsin. They didn't seem to know that those states were in play. So that's where the blame goes, right? Like, I don't blame Jill Stein. I don't care about that. What I do is I try and use this platform to do good. Like, one of the things I really, really regret from 2016 is not doing more to try and elect Hillary Clinton. Right. I look back and boy, like if we could have put out a couple more episodes, if I could have done a couple more days, I sure would like to have done more. And so since then, I'm trying to do everything I can to make sure Donald Trump is not reelected in 2020. So let me be 100% clear on this. The numbers show. Right. And I want to modify a little bit of what you said. If every person who voted for Jill Stein in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Michigan had instead voted for Hillary Clinton, then Hillary Clinton would have won. And so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, OK. It is so he's just factually wrong on the, this question.
Well, no, look, like because then if you take the Gary Johnson votes or whatever. Right. Like there are a number of ways in which he could be right as a form of alternate history. Right. Like he could be right in that many of those Stein voters said, oh, well, if I hadn't voted for Stein, I would have.
Oh, they would have voted for Trump, right. Maybe.
And if you take all the Stein votes and assign them to Hillary, but all the Johnson votes and assign them to Trump, or even assign you know, 2-1 to Trump, like you still wind up, like, I'm not trying to run things backwards. I am trying to speak to those voters. And I'm saying, if you voted third party in 2016, right? And let's break this down. If you voted third party for Gary Johnson in 2016 because you're a libertarian, this show does speak to you, right? We've run at least two episodes. Libertarianism is bad and you should feel bad. Libertarianism is still bad and you should still feel bad. Like, we're trying to persuade you that your position on philosophical libertarianism is a mistake. That's how we're trying to reach out to the Gary Johnson voters. To the Jill Stein voters, right? Those are people who are on the far left, who would rather see Hillary Clinton be president than Donald Trump be president. And I am trying, and you're trying, to reach out to them in a strategic way. I actually just saw a report on this, right? Like, this is from the other side, but I think the point is well made. There were two, I'm going to upload them in the show notes. There were two articles in the New York Times, one December 19th, one just about 12 days ago, January 7th, about how Democrats in the Doug Jones, Roy Moore race in Alabama used the same kind of trolling tactics on social media. And one of the techniques that they, as the Russians have done, right, that they deliberately have copied the Russia-Trump playbook, which is kind of terrifying. We could talk about on a later episode whether, you know, whether the Democrats should play as dirty as the Republicans. I think I know where you come out on that, Thomas. But one of the strategic elements that they did in the Jones race was there were Democrats that posed as conservatives on social media and tried to get other conservatives to vote for the write-in third-party candidate Mac Watson instead of for Roy Moore.
Oh, that's so close to blank box.
Yeah, I know.
It sounds similar.
We know that the Russians did the same thing, encouraging liberals to stay home or to write in or to protest vote for Bernie Sanders, right? And I would humbly suggest to Jill Stein voter, and this is my last thing. Again, we lose patrons every time I do this, but I feel very strongly about it. If your technique of sending a message is indistinguishable from what the other side wants you to do to screw up the election, right? From what Russian troll farms are trying to get you to do, or for our MAGA Red Hatter fan, for what covert Democratic operatives were trying to do to disrupt conservatives, right? Like,
yeah.
If that's it, if your message is indistinguishable from what causes your opponents to squeal with delight as the best possible outcome for
them. If you're the apple trees in Wizard of Oz and the other side is like, oh, I sure hope you don't throw any of those delicious apples over here to send a message to us about how awful we are. And then you start throwing the apples over, like maybe question your motive. Yeah, like the motives of the... Anyway, yeah. That was a weird comparison, yeah. But it's like that.
I like that. Yeah, no, that's exactly what it's like. So
it's like the apple tree being like, I'm going to send a message to the Tin Man by throwing this apple. And then, like, meanwhile, the Russians are like, yeah, we're trying to get them to throw apples right over here. So thank you.
And look, the response, we're going to get to this, are the people who say, well, I just in principle, you know, need a candidate who inspires me or whatever. I want you to understand from a public perception, right? From my position as the co-host of Opening Arguments, I can and I try to reach out to voters. And in particular, this is a left-leaning show. We have a lot of liberal voters who are part of our audience. I can do that. So I can put my plan into action, which is to say, you as a Democrat should fight hard in the primary for the candidate of your choice, and then you should line up behind that candidate in the general election. And put a pin in that because I want to speak specifically to that in a second. I can't do the thing that the Jill Stein voters want me to do, right? Like they say, like, oh, well, you know, if the Democratic Party would change its nomination process and only give me a candidate that's further left and inspires me and blah, blah. Like, look, I can't do that, right? Like, so the only thing I can do to try and make this country better.
Well, and side note, the DNC is changing a ton of their processes and they're getting rid of a lot of superdelegates and they're doing stuff along those lines. But yeah.
Which, by the way, is a terrible strategic thing, right? Like, look, I've mentioned this on the air before. This is another side, you know, rabbit trail. But, like, I worked for Howard Dean in 2004. Howard Dean got screwed in 2004 by John Kerry far worse than Bernie Sanders got screwed by Hillary Clinton in 2016 by any objective measure. Nevertheless, and by the superdelegates, nevertheless, I'm really glad that the Democratic Party had superdelegates such that they could not get hijacked by a Donald Trump. I would hate to see
Well, but is that true, though? I think the main, well, side topic again, but the superdelegates, if it's going to be an outrage if they ever turn the table, like turn the election against the will of the Democrat primary voters, I think we're to the point in the process where nobody wants that, and so they're useless, so we might as well get rid of them.
That's a fair point, and we can continue to debate that.
Okay, well, we'll side top, we'll table that.
So yeah, I can't make those structural changes. I can't do what you want me to do when you're a Stein voter. I can argue with you that you ought to think about your vote as a strategic tool and not as some kind of philosophical, Solomonic, moral principle handed down, because it isn't. And that's the argument I'm trying to make. Now, I want to spend a word talking about fight in the primaries, coalesce in the general. I think it is really, really critical. Look, like, I love the idea of having a robust fight with voices from the far left in our primaries, right? I am probably to the right of you, Thomas. I am certainly to the right of some of our listeners. And so, but I welcome those voices in the primary. But I've already started to see the same kind of toxic behavior that we saw in 2016. Oh,
yeah. We're going to see it. Yeah. It's going to happen.
I want us to fight on ideas in the primary, right? So I'm seeing people sharing about, in particular, about Elizabeth Warren, about Cory Booker, about Kamala Harris, and just recently about Tulsi Gabbard. If there are policy differences, we should debate those out in the primary. But I don't want you to get to a position where you fall in love with your candidate such that you hate everybody else and start sharing garbage. And you and I can talk about somebody you've had on SIO, somebody we've engaged with, a prominent far left individual we don't need to name right now, who repeatedly quoted and shared out Fox News memes during the general election in 2016 about Hillary Clinton. Right. There's a prominent socialist. Oh, Hillary Clinton, corporatist Democrat. So therefore, I'm going to share the exact, not just the exact same arguments, but from the source, from Fox News. We saw that the Bernie Sanders DNC lawsuit was not just funded by, but orchestrated and staffed by right wingers who quoted and whose source was Guccifer 2.0, a Russian operative with ties to the Russian intelligence community, in order to bring that lawsuit. Like, this is what I mean when, you know, I talk about and you know, we could have a debate on horseshoe theory. I know folks wrote in when I use that language. When you have folks on the far left sharing not just the same content, but literally the same stories from the right attacking the Democratic candidate, like, that's my definition of horseshoe, right? Like, if there's another proof of something else, then you know, whatever, there's something else. But that is how. Look, that is part of the strategy. We've seen this in the Senate Intelligence Committee report that the Russians used to sow dissension in our election. And again, if you're going to play into the political strategies of a hostile foreign power that is trying to subvert our democracy, I don't know what else I can say about that. So be careful. So that's what I'm saying. Like, get out there. Like, I loved the 2016 primary for the most part, right? Like, if you want.
Yeah, I didn't mind what the candidates said. Yes. I didn't like what a lot of the supporters said. But as far as, you know, Bernie and Hillary went, it really wasn't that bad.
Really,
like, they
wasn't.
Didn't.
No.
And like, just looking at the candidates themselves, it really wasn't that awful.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that 100%. Right, I think that it was the supporters that wound up getting too polarized and said. But like, I love the idea of saying, hey, like, are we ready for a Democratic socialist as the nominee of the Democratic Party, or do we want a more, you know, institutional mainstream candidate?
Right.
That's a legitimate public policy argument to have. And the Sanders campaign pushed Hillary Clinton to the left during the general election, right? Like Hillary Clinton came out with the public college funding plan that was largely a reaction to and inspired by what Sanders did in the primary. That's the best of our primary system. So to that end, like I just saw, I don't know if you saw this report, it was in Politico. Politico, in my view, has a rightward cast, and this had kind of a sneering sort of tone to it about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the group that funded her, a group called Justice Democrats, that's looking to primary other conservative Democrats. And they put it as a kind of like, see, you're causing dissension in there. Like, to me, that's awesome, right? Go for it. I love
Sanders. Yeah, I don't understand that as a threat. Oh, we're going to primary. Okay, well, if you get more people to vote for your candidate in the primary, then you win the primary. I don't know. There's no, you know, like, there's no, like, loyalty. Like, no, this person has to win no matter how many people want it or not. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, primary anybody you want.
Yep.
That being said, you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard. I do think it's legitimate to look into her history of homophobia. I'm actually I didn't even know about it until it came out, and I'm very uncomfortable with that. If she were the candidate, I would still vote for her in the general. But, you know, I think it's valid to, I wasn't sure what you were suggesting there, but I think it's valid to look into that history of hers and want to hear a good answer from her about it.
I agree. I think that and this is what I said in the community, like to me on face, right, when the first comment and meme got shared out, what I said was, usually when somebody had a terrible position in the past and has changed it, we view that as a good thing and not a bad thing. And so, you know, that is contingent upon Tulsi Gabbard, who is, you know, today a member of the Progressive Democratic Caucus, being pro LGBTQ rights. If that's not the case, if there's some argument that that's pretextual, I want to hear it. But otherwise,
right.
I think the focus on, I think it was a, you know, 2001 statement. And again, a terrible statement, not one that I, you know, defend or agree.
Well, there's a lot there. But, we should save it for later.
I would say, I think we're in agreement, right? Like, dig in on the facts. Don't get distracted and in by sort of the memes. Tulsi Gabbard has zero chance of being the nominee, by the way. But, you know, we both know that.
I'll be honest with you. I don't know who has any chance of being in a crowded, you know, 200 person field. I really don't know how it's going to shake up. I mean, Trump won the Republican nomination. I mean, it's a different setup.
Never say never. Fair point.
I know. It's like, I agree with you that it's unlikely, but like, I honestly, who the heck knows? I don't know. I did really want, I've been holding my tongue on saying something from earlier. I know we have a lot to get to, so I don't want to be too long, but this is something, when you talk about blame for the election, it's something I've talked a ton about on my show because I think it's more in the realm of philosophy. I think it has a lot in common with like a tragedy of the commons type philosophical problem. And it's an argument I've had with a lot of people who want to just blame Hillary. I think in some ways you blame the campaign. And it's certainly valid to critique anywhere that the campaign might have fallen short. But I want to just quickly put forth a hypothetical, or not even a hypothetical, but like a framework for thinking about this. A lot of people are very quick to jump on me when I say I kind of blame the voters. I actually blame the voters for making the wrong choice. Like, I think people had a ton of wrong ideas about the consequences of this election and what made sense in terms of how bad Trump would be, how much worse it is, you know, putting what you think or what they think Hillary Clinton's flaws were, and not putting that in proper perspective and not evaluating how serious the damage to the Supreme Court is and to our country. I think people were wrong about that, and I blame people. And I, you know, just to draw a comparison, people are mad at me. They say, no, it's always the candidate. The candidate is the one to blame. They're the one to blame no matter what, because they're the one who's running the election. And I wonder how people hypothetically would think about, you know, an election in like the early 1800s when, or something like that, like a super racist pro-slavery candidate, like James Polk or something. Do you blame the person who ran against Polk for losing? Like if you, I'm serious. Like, I'm just genuinely curious. How would you think of that? Would you say, well, they failed. They should have been able to win because that guy was a pro-slavery, anti-abolition. Or is it possible that the country was just full of a bunch of wrong, crappy people at the time? Like, there's just too many. You know what I mean? It's a weird, when you think of blame, I think when we blame Hillary or whoever it is for not magically convincing enough people to do the right thing, we just treat it sometimes as though the right thing is always obvious and it's yours to lose. Like if you're right or you're better, you should have this incredible advantage. And if you screw it up, like by losing to Trump, then you must have just gone, you know, you must have just totally messed up. And I would suggest that we've seen that that's not really the case, that it being right or having the better platform objectively by a million does not really, in this day and age, or in any day and age, maybe, give you this unbeatable advantage. It's actually sometimes that your country is full of too many people with really wrong ideas, and it's too much to ask that you magically convince a bunch of people that they're wrong. So that's all I would say philosophically about that.
I'm really glad you said that, and you know, it dovetails back in with what I said to begin with, right? I want to use my platform to try and reach the people that I think I can reach, right? And so if you voted for Trump because you agree with the things that Trump said and, you know, you continue to support Trump today, that's going to be really difficult for anything I say to convince you. But if you voted for Jill Stein, my guess is that we probably have a lot in common. We probably agree on 85 to 90% of things. And I'm hoping that I can convince that person. And so, it's not about blame. It's about trying to make the country better.
All right. Well, too bad we took a lot of time on that segment, but I think it was really good. But you're under the gun here, Torres. We better get to Alex Jones and let's see how quickly you get through these bullet points. I don't know. Hey, listeners, today's show is brought to you by Joybird. Joybird believes that you should never settle when it comes to your home furnishings and that you should always have the freedom to be boldly original. From idea to reality, they empower you to create the space and furniture that brings you joy. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture made to your unique tastes. Turn your ideas into reality with hundreds of styles and options. I'm going to try to read the list of styles and choices you might have. It's a tongue twister. This is not an easy one. Mid-century modern to contemporary classics. Customizable in an amazing array of fabric choices, from rich buttery leather, that sounds delicious, and plush velvets to every color imaginable. They've got a wide range of kid and pet friendly. Oh my God, hold on, I need this. I need both kid and pet friendly right now. Upholstery options available. Free personal design consultants help nail down your perfect design. Okay, here's what's so amazing about Joybird. This is incredible. Listen up. There's a 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store and bring the showroom to your home. You can sit on it, sleep on it, break it in, and if you don't love it, you can return for a full refund. That is not an error. 365 days. You just have it for that long to try. Hassle-free in-home delivery. They'll even remove all the packing materials. They also have free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. So go see how Joybird is revolutionizing online furniture shopping. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/OA. Go to joybird.com/OA and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code OA.
I came knocking on your door a million times, and you laughed at me. You've been in love with something else your whole life, and this is a love affair. And so I'm not going to get in bed with you because you don't love the spirit of justice. You love your father, the devil.
All right. So what's going on with this Sandy Hook lawsuit?
Yeah. So let me say, as kind of an overview, I really have difficulty with this, right? So what is the lawsuit about? The lawsuit is about Alex Jones repeatedly over a period of years. And I'm going to link, there's a little over seven minute video from Media Matters for America that is a compilation of everything Alex Jones has said about Sandy Hook. It is disgusting, right? He is accused it of being a false flag government operation planted by the Obama administration, and that the parents and the victims are crisis actors, and it's as horrible a thing as you can do in politics. Longstanding listeners know that 9/11 truthers have come after the memory of a childhood friend of mine, Liz Wainio, who was one of the people who died on the Pennsylvania flight that crashed on 9/11. And they've looked at her photo that was circulating on the internet. There were only a couple. And they've come up with all these crackpot theories about how she's not a real person and a composite. And, you know, this is part of the 9/11 truther movement. And not a close friend, but she was a friend of mine. Right. And so I can only imagine what it's like to, you know, lose a family member and then have, you know, politically motivated nuts tell you that, you know, you're part of a government conspiracy. On the other hand, as between you and I, like I certainly tend to want to come down on the free speech side of the equation. And let me be very, very clear. I am concerned on the merits that a court will have difficulty distinguishing, drawing the kinds of bright lines between Alex Jones and, say, opening arguments. I think you can write those. I think you can describe what they are. But I think that maybe have difficulty isn't quite the right word, but I think that the way in which our existing defamation laws are phrased and interpreted is not well suited to resolve those distinctions. How about that? Maybe that's a better way to put it. Right, that we're operating in a New York Times v. Sullivan world, which thinks of, you know, defamation as being something that happens in newspapers and is not well suited to adjudicating somebody like Alex Jones. You had a thought on that.
I'm going to sit here and listen more because I'm curious. I feel like this should be a pretty clear line, but maybe I'm wrong, so I'll wait until you break it down.
All right.
More.
Well, so let's explain first the clear harm that comes about here, right? And this should go without saying, but whenever you're talking about free speech issues, I think it's really, really important to talk about the human cost here. We know what happened with Pizzagate, right? An armed person showed up with an assault rifle and threatened to shoot up the place if he didn't get to see the basement of Comet Ping Pong to release the kids that were being raped by Hillary Clinton and John Podesta. Comet Ping Pong does not have a basement. Fortunately, that person was talked off the ledge and didn't shoot up the place. Alex Jones has done the same thing with respect to Sandy Hook as he did with Pizzagate. This is, I'm going to read directly from the New York Times article, but this is an established fact that Sandy Hook families have been followed, videotaped, harassed by Alex Jones fans and by others who are conspiracy theorists, demanding that they reveal their role in the conspiracy. When the town of Newtown, Connecticut put up various monuments to the Sandy Hook victims, those monuments have been defaced, vandalized, stolen, broken. Just as another example, Leonard Posner, father of one of the victims, was stalked by an Alex Jones devotee, by somebody who listens to InfoWars, who sent emails and phone calls and death threats, including "look behind you, it is death," over email. And that required the Posner family to relocate to a community with 24-hour round-the-clock security. This has real human cost. This is weaponizing morons to terrorize innocent people. And as the complaint alleges, doing so deliberately, right? The complaint alleges, as a matter of fact, Alex Jones knows that the Sandy Hook shooting was not a false flag operation, and he continues to say false things about it anyway. So
open and shut case for me right there.
I hear you. there are some interesting legal issues with respect to this. So the first is the Sandy Hook shooting occurred in 2012, and the statute of limitations on defamation is 2 years. And so the complaint involves the continuing repetition of those statements over time. And the issue that the courts are not well prepared to address is what happens when you do what Alex Jones did. Okay. And let's specifically define what he's done in this case, which is beginning with very, very explicit statements in 2013. This is a false flag operation. This was orchestrated by the Obama government. These people are actors. This is all made up. And then over time, making the statements slightly more nuanced in order to kind of create an atmosphere of plausible deniability while continuing to dog whistle, right? Never walking back the original claim. And so the statements that are within the 2 year statute of limitations, and this lawsuit was filed May of 2018, right? So anything May of 2016 or later, well, one of the things that that the complaint does is go through the continuing reference that builds upon those earlier statements, right? But as a result, right, it's not quite the same. Like usually, you think of a defamation case as involving a single statement or set of statements or an article, right? Like when I get clients who call me and say, "I'm being sued for defamation," or Eli Bosnick, "I'd like to say this about somebody and not get sued for defamation," right? You want to focus on the content of those original statements, right? But what happened in the Alex Jones Sandy Hook case, what happened in Pizzagate is, again, a second issue that I think the courts really are not well prepared to grapple with yet, and that is the cumulative effect of multiple statements. Right. There's not any one. There are a few in Pizzagate. Right. But in Pizzagate, what happened was you had series of statements that built upon each other that created this overall gestalt of, OK, right. There's Comet Ping Pong and Hillary Clinton and John Podesta are raping children in the basement. But you can't find a single statement. Right. That puts all of those elements together. It's this sort of slow burn over time. And the Sandy Hook is kind of a similar situation where the natural tendency, I think, of most decent people is not to sue over statement number one. But then now you've had statements 2 through 10 through 15 through 100. And the later ones may be less inflammatory, but may be fanning the fires from the original one. That's another kind of scenario in which the courts are ill-prepared to handle it. Here's how Alex Jones's lawyer, Mark Randazza. It's Mark Randazza's firm. It's a junior partner named Jay Woolman who's writing this. Mark Randazza has sniped back at us on Twitter. So just for disclaimer purposes. But here's how he describes the lawsuit. He says, "Plaintiffs and their counsel have already tried this case in the press, falsely claiming that Mr. Jones himself orchestrated a campaign to continually state that the shooting never happened. Despite the complaint being filled with statements attributed to Mr. Jones and his related companies, few were identified as false, and no plaintiff was identified by defendants. Rather, they assert that listeners, quote, would understand these statements to assert that the Sandy Hook massacre was staged and that the plaintiffs fabricated the deaths of their loved ones. The allegations as to Mr. Jones' statements are all either summaries of what other people said, questions about evidence, or opinions as to the credibility of the evidence. The sole exception is from December 28, 2014, more than 3 years before the complaint was filed, where Mr. Jones, relying on Mr. Halbig, we're going to talk about him in a minute, referred to the shootings as a hoax and fake news in less than 2 minutes of an 83-minute show. However, almost immediately thereafter, after continuing to examine and question the prevailing narrative, Mr. Jones concluded that the shooting happened. He has said so many times since then. That's how, again, that was filed as of the day of this recording. That was filed on January 17th, 2019 in court. That appears to be false, right? Like that from everything I can tell in researching this lawsuit, that's not what happened. And in any event, you as the defendant do not get to you're not entitled to that characterization of the facts before discovery, right? Like that's at best a spin on the facts, right? I want to go to the New York Times because I tried to find the original of this, and I think Alex Jones has removed it because of the lawsuit, which makes sense. The New York Times, in May of 2018, as this lawsuit was filed, was quoting the Alex Jones final statement on Sandy Hook. And I want to point out what I did for you listeners. I went to Infowars.com and typed that into the search bar. Yeah, and I
hope you use protection.
I was just going to say I very stupidly did it on a regular browser. Like I should have clearly used an incognito browser. That doesn't show up in a search.
I think there's some website you can use to not even give the website like the fact that you're visiting, you know, like to not even like the whatever ads are on it or whatever. I think there's something you can use that somebody tweeted us or whatever. I'm pretty sure that exists.
That could prove useful for lots of browsing reasons.
Yeah.
So here's the Times quoting Alex Jones in his final statement on Sandy Hook. Quote, "If children were lost in Sandy Hook, my heart goes out to each and every one of those parents and the people that say they're parents that I see on the news. The only problem is I've watched a lot of soap operas and I've seen actors before." End of quote. That does not seem to match up with Mr. Randazza's characterization of what Alex Jones has said. And
case closed.
And how do you match that against against saying, right? Like suppose a week later, right, he says on one of his shows, "Oh yeah, well, right, you know, I believe, right, you know, certainly something happened at Sandy Hook, right?" Like, how do you match that up?
You're the lawman. You figure it out. I think what you do, like, if you sit a jury and say, "Hey, this guy has a show with, I don't know if it's a million it's probably millions, 2 million listeners, and he is convinced somehow through whatever means." A large enough number of them that this shooting didn't happen. These people are actors to the point where they're being stalked and harassed and whatever. Yeah, let's let the lawyers figure out the details, but he should just find him guilty of something. He's guilty of something. And then Andrew Torres figure out what. That's your job. Figure it out.
I will say to you, that is kind of what's going on in this case. So let's talk about that from a strategic perspective. The parents of the Newtown victims who have sued Alex Jones in state court in Newtown, Connecticut, right? And immediately you might ask yourself sort of the diversity question, right? Like Alex Jones lives in Texas. InfoWars is based out of Texas. They've also sued two of the business partners, right? A company called Genesis Communications Network that is based out of Minnesota. And Midas Resources, which is the dietary supplement and garbage company that runs ads on InfoWars, that Alex Jones makes a reported $7 to $12 million per year hawking that nonsense. Because I guess if you're stupid enough to believe conspiracy theories, you're probably also stupid enough to believe in dietary supplements. And come at me, Midas Resources, feel free. So you might be saying, how could a Connecticut group of plaintiffs sue a Texas person, Texas business entities, and Minnesota business entities in state court in Connecticut? Couldn't you remove that to federal court and under diversity jurisdiction, right? They're citizens of different states. And the answer is that that's exactly what Alex Jones tried to do in this case. And what the Sandy Hook parents' lawyer did that's clever and is perfectly acceptable practice is they added as a defendant a guy named Corey Sklanka. Corey Sklanka worked as a driver and a camera operator for a guy named Wolfgang Halbig. Wolfgang, in turn, was the expert, which I say with sarcasm quotes around it, that Alex Jones had on his show, who ostensibly debunked the video and, you know, is Halbig himself is a Sandy Hook truth denier. He runs a site called sandyhookjustice.com that is terrifying. And as a sidebar, we can't go into it. He's representing himself in this lawsuit, and he has filed the kind of delightfully mad pleadings that only a pro se plaintiff can, pro se defendant, conspiracy theorist can file in a case. It's truly impressive, the level to which he does not understand the law and thinks that he does. It's amazing. But the important part is, by including Corey, who the facts are clear, drove for Mr. Halbig and worked as a camera operator for Mr. Halbig, by including Corey as a defendant, Corey lives in Connecticut. So that defeats complete diversity. Alex Jones removed the case to federal court. And again, this is all strategic, right? The plaintiffs want the case in state court for exactly the reasons that you've just identified, right? Because if it gets to a jury in Connecticut, that jury is going to find Alex Jones guilty of something, right? They're going to listen to this nonsense, and they are going to rule in favor of the plaintiffs. If it goes into federal court, a federal court is very likely to entertain a motion to dismiss on some of the technical legal reasons that we've talked about. So, July 13th, case was removed to federal court. I'm going to upload that to the show notes. The argument that Alex Jones made at that was fraudulent joinder. You've only brought in this Corey guy because he's in Connecticut. That the claim should be dismissed out against Corey, and then you should keep this case in federal court. And the federal court said, no, we're not going to do that. The standard is that as long as the complaint alleges viable causes of action against Corey Sklenka, the plaintiffs have the right to sue him, and they have the right to sue him as a part of this action. And if that happens strategically to defeat your diversity jurisdiction, too bad. Plaintiff is the master of his or her own complaint, and as long as they're properly here, that's not a fraudulent joinder. And they go through the specifics of the allegations. I don't elide over that for time. But so in November, federal court remanded the cause of action back down to the state court. And so you would think that what happens at that point is you go into discovery, right? You then say, hey, look, like you tried to move to dismiss. We won on that. You tried to go to federal court. We won on that. Now we're back. We want discovery. Alex Jones then and his lawyers move to the next phase of their defense, which is proceeding under the Connecticut anti-SLAPP laws, right? And so their argument is, we've talked about anti-SLAPP laws. Connecticut's law mirrors that of California, so it is among one of the most robust in the country. SLAPP is strategic lawsuits against public participation. And the way in which anti-SLAPP laws work is they provide an early mechanism, an early escape valve for people who are journalists who are improperly sued for defamation, basically, right? Anybody who's improperly sued for defamation, but journalists are the most obvious ones because it has to affect public participation. So if this is an issue of public importance and you can then meet the standards of prevailing on your special motion to dismiss, you get to get out at an early stage without, even though you might not prevail on a normal motion to dismiss, right? Because it requires a heightened showing, and typically, you know, standard motions to dismiss, even in defamation cases, right? The plaintiff is entitled to assert facts. And if there's a dispute over the facts, you go to discovery. The idea behind anti-SLAPP laws was to not allow journalists to be intimidated into silence or settlement because that diminishes the quality of public discourse. So, right. That's sort of what I meant at the outset by the interrelationship between InfoWars and opening arguments, right? We're pro anti-SLAPP laws. Those are by and large good things. here's how.
Sure, it just shouldn't apply here.
Yeah, and the court did something that I have never seen before. It's really interesting, and it is the serious reason why I wanted to cover this case. Under the anti-slap statute in Connecticut, the court may, after a showing of good cause, quote, order specific and limited discovery relevant to the special motion to dismiss. So in other words, the court hasn't thrown out Alex Jones's anti-slap motion to dismiss. They've just said, okay, you think that this is a strategic lawsuit against public participation? Let's find out if it is. They're entitled to discovery to find out if it is. And that was the ruling that came down just a couple of days ago. And on the 17th of January, Alex Jones and the InfoWars defendants filed a notice of interlocutory appeal to seek certification, right? Because again, OA listeners know when you just lose on a motion for protective order, or in this case, in fighting the discovery order under the anti-slap statute, like, you don't get to immediately appeal that. You only get to appeal a final judgment. So the case was going to go forward until they filed for this effort for an interlocutory appeal. So we are going to be watching to see if the Connecticut Intermediate Appellate Court certifies this case for appeal. It's shocking to me that Alex Jones has appealed everything here, that he will not turn over any information to the plaintiffs. I think that there are...
What information even is that? Because isn't this all just public stuff?
Yeah.
That he's, recordings and...
Yeah, let's talk really, really quickly about this is what the subject of the dispute is about. The court ordered five interrogatories, and depending on the defendant, because like I said, there are a bunch of these defendants, 18 to 19 document requests. The interrogatories are boilerplate interrogatories. Just for definition purposes, in discovery, an interrogatory is when you ask a party to answer a question, right? So for example, interrogatory number one, they've objected to this, says, identify A, your officers, B, your shareholders or other owners, C, your employees, D, all business organizations or other entities in which you have ownership and or control. That is a perfectly standard boilerplate interrogatory that you serve in every single case, right? And the reason you do that is so that you know, right, when you have a corporate defendant, as with InfoWars LLC and a couple other like crazy LLCs that interlock that. I mean, Alex Jones very clearly has used, and again, there's nothing wrong with this on face, but he's got a company called Free Speech Systems LLC that owns InfoWars.com, even though InfoWars LLC owns the content. Prison Planet TV LLC distributes some of the content, right? So you need to know as a plaintiff who owns what and who's responsible for what so that you have the right parties joined to the lawsuit, right? It's a totally standard interrogatory. I don't know why you wouldn't provide that, right? Like, there's no reason not to. It clearly has taken more litigation time to say this would be overly burdensome than it would be to have somebody just write down the answer, but there you go. Second interrogatory asks to identify the employees who are responsible for marketing data and analytics concerning the shows. The third asks to identify the employees responsible for investigating any matter related to the Sandy Hook shooting. Again, that's totally obvious as to why that's relevant in a defamation lawsuit, right? As the plaintiffs, as public figures, as the Sandy Hook parents are, because they've spoken out in public about the tragedy and have lobbied for gun legislation and the like, they're required to prove actual malice. So in order to prove actual malice, you have to show that Alex Jones acted either with reckless disregard of the truth or with knowing falsity of the truth. And part of how you show that is by showing you didn't do any research, right? Asking who did the research. So totally straightforward interrogatory. Identify your domain names and URLs. Identify each individual likely to have discoverable information. Those are boilerplate interrogatories. The document requests are similar. I'm not going to go through them line by line. I will tell you there are a couple that are arguably overbroad. Then there were a couple that the court rejected. The court rejected requests for tax returns. Tax returns are presumptively confidential. And sometimes you get them if they're related to the case in general discovery, but I can see not getting them in this limited discovery phase. They also rejected the last one, a catch-all that said all documents you may use to support any of your claims or defenses. That's another boilerplate document request. It's one that they will get if they survive this intermediate special motion to dismiss stage. But you can understand the court not granting it at this phase. Additionally, I think that the request for example, number 11 wanted all of Alex Jones's depositions from the past 10 years. That's standard in litigation. It's a totally reasonable request, but maybe not at this stage, right? Like there's some narrowing that could have been done, but courts have broad discretion to issue discovery. And most of this, I think, is clearly tied into the core issue, which is, Can you prove the allegations of actual malice here? And the plaintiffs have said, yeah, we can prove it. Just give us access to the research that they've done and the communications about that, right? Because, oh boy, if we see the emails between Alex Jones and this, you know, and his internal producers, we suspect that those emails are gonna include something, you know, joking about it, right? Mm-hmm. Something that gives away the game. That's their suspicion. That's why Alex Jones won't produce any discovery right now. Not a shred of paper, not a single answer. The only reason, in my view, and again, Mark Grandazza listens, wants to come on the show. Great, we'll have him on. In my view, the only reason to object to providing the org chart of InfoWars, to object to identifying the people who did the research is because you don't want to open the door at all. Your position is, yeah, you can't see any of our documents because, God, if you see our documents, we're in a world of trouble. That's my
point. I object because it's crippling to my case.
It's devastating to my case, Your Honor.
Yeah, devastating to my case. Yeah.
So, lots more that we could talk about, but that's where we stand right now. So you have seen a lot of news reports, I know, because folks tweeted it at us, sent it to us on Facebook and email. You have seen reports that said judge ordered discovery in Sandy Hook case. That's true, but that's on hold pending the filing of this motion to be certified for an interlocutory appeal. If and when the Connecticut courts deny that motion, then he will have to start producing documents or face contempt charges. That will be a really, really interesting development. And it'll also be interesting if the Connecticut Appellate Court takes this up on appeal. I hope they don't, right? It's very clear to me InfoWars is a wealthy outfit. It's hired counsel that has already filed hundreds of documents in this case. They have already attempted to remove to federal court. It's the classic, and again, I don't begrudge this. I don't begrudge a lawyer doing what is best for your client, but it's a classic delaying tactic. And having to resolve these questions on an interlocutory appeal will delay getting the basic information that these plaintiffs need to bring their case forward. And that goes back to the very beginning. Look, when they get the information, their case may be fatally flawed, right? Like it's really hard to prove actual malice. And Jones had this guy, right? I mean, you know, they may prevail. The plaintiffs in this case may only prevail against, say, Wolfgang Halbig, right? He's the guy who went on Alex Jones's show and said, I'm a forensic investigator and you can see how, you know, blah, blah, like that it's a reasonable defense to say, I brought in an expert, I did some research, and so, you know, I had, that's enough due diligence that it's not reckless disregard for the truth, right? Like, to win, and that's true, by the way, to win, what the plaintiffs are going to have to find is an email from Alex Jones to somebody else on his staff, or from one producer at InfoWars to another staffer at InfoWars saying, oh yeah, we're going to run with the Sandy Hook thing again. Like, I can't believe the yokels that listen. Like, and there may be, right? That may exist. But if those documents don't exist, then there may not be a defamation case under the New York
Times. Well, then that's just a problem with the law and the legal system, because there's the malice is you're saying that a bunch of people whose kids were murdered are faking it. Can that be de facto malice? Because that's how it should work.
It is certainly malicious, but actual malice in the New York Times standard does not mean proving the mental state of maliciousness. It means proving either that you did not care whether something was true or false, or that you knew it was false.
Well, I'm saying he should we're approaching this, or the legal system rather seems to be approaching this in a complete relativistic sense, like all facts are could be true or false. There are some things that are so stupid and evil that just by saying them, you know, they're fake. Like there's only a few things like that in my book. And pretending as though some parents whose kids were murdered by guns are faking it, that's something that you know is, by definition, you know is wrong. So there's my case for it.
So noted, I will tell you, and this is free legal advice for Randazza, the response is going to be, hey, look, we tried to figure it out. Right? We brought in an expert who broke things down, and we were not indifferent as to whether it was true or false. And if this guy thinks it could be true, then we think it could be true.
Yeah, but what about the other statements where he said, I've seen soap opera actor, all that? That wasn't an expert.
I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that. I'm trying to you know, construct the argument, but I think that sort of goes back to the point I led off with, which is, you know, are we looking at the cumulative effect of all of the defamatory statements? Because certainly the worst, in my view, and again, I'm going to upload this Media Matters clip. The cumulative effect is really damning. And the plaintiffs, if this gets to go before a jury, the plaintiffs are going to play something like that for the jury, and they're going to take Thomas, your approach.
You cannot have a more sympathetic plaintiff than that. You know, like I really hope it goes through, and I hope they're able to do it, because you're the expert on all the law, but I know the result that should happen is he should be guilty. I don't even care how it works. Figure it out, because it's the most disgusting use of speech maybe ever. Like, I don't know that it gets much worse than this in the history of speech. So figure it out, lawyers, in my opinion.
I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes, you
have. I have not. I said
the
president of the United States. There is not a single bit of evidence the president of the United States committed the only crime you could commit here, conspired with the Russians to hack the DNC.
All right. Well, we promised yodeling, and you better, Andrew, give us just at least a tiny bit of yodeling. And I know we're running late, but we can manage.
All right.
Let's yodel a little bit.
two quick yodels. Number one, Rudy Giuliani being the gift that just keeps on giving. Rudy Giuliani said the day before this recording, I never said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, only that Donald Trump himself was not involved in the collusion. Quote, I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign. End of quote. Giuliani said on CNN's Cuomo primetime.
What is the point? It's just going to be just a blanket quote, you know, should be, I never said whatever the thing that now is true is. I said, it doesn't matter. It's useless. This guy's useless.
I think, though, that again, we're keeping the pulse on how high up Yodel Mountain we are. When you're at the point where the personal lawyer defending you is like, well, yeah, look, obviously the campaign colluded with Russia, but I really don't think Trump himself did anything. That's bad for you, right?
Yeah.
And I don't see how. I mean, this is another one of these where, you know, when If Mueller were to indict Donald Trump Jr., for example, you know, you'd piggyback right on those sentences, right? Yeah. Well, I guess. I mean, you know, we know he was at the Trump Tower meeting. I guess that there was sufficient evidence that he's one of those folks in the campaign that that had that connection. It's look, Rudy Giuliani may be, you know, a senile grandpa who natters for no apparent reason. He's been remarkably loose-lipped about things before the facts have come out, right? Like, you may recall that Giuliani was the first person to say that Michael Cohen was paid via retainer, right? We covered it on the show. And we were like, why in the hell is he saying that? And then after Cohen's plea agreement, like, we found out that they were laundering payments back in connection with Stormy Daniels by grossing it up for taxes, giving him a bonus on top and calling it a retainer, which is a much worse crime than just paying him back. Right. So I think that, you know, we've referenced the classic Michael Kinsley. A gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. I'm looking at that on Giuliani. All right. So that's point one. Rudy Giuliani is not helping. Point two is now opening arguments fan favorite, Michael Cohen. Did you see the story where it was a Wall Street Journal article where the CIO of Liberty University, a guy named John Gager, who also runs a polling firm, was...
Is this why Liberty University was trending on Twitter? Yep. I hadn't gotten to it. It must be this.
Yep. Was hired by the Trump campaign directly via Michael Cohen to try and rig certain polls in the Republican primary. Here's what Gager says. Gager says he was hired to rig a CNBC online poll. And look, like, if you can't rig an online poll like that.
Yeah. I just assume they're rigged. I don't. Who actually thinks those are valuable?
You probably work for Liberty University. That was January of 2014, hired Gager to sway a CNBC online poll of the top American business leaders with a program that would cast auto votes for Donald Trump. But that failed to put Donald Trump in the top 100. And like, I don't know. Like, I'm a business lawyer. I guess I could name.
Who was even voting in these? Yeah.
I could probably name 100 business professionals, right? Like 100 business leaders. You know, you go, who are the top? Okay, well, Steve Jobs is dead. Warren Buffett. Okay, that's one. Elon Musk. Well, he's kind of nuts. All right, that's two, right? Like, getting to 100 and not picking Donald Trump in 2014, like, that's a challenge, but he failed to do that. Then in February 2015, Gager was hired by Cohen to boost Trump in a Drudge Report poll on potential 2016 Republican presidential candidates. By the way, that tells you, right, that Trump, and again, Trump toyed with running in 2012, but these seem to be serious efforts about actually running much earlier than you know, we've previously seen. Anyway. Enough on that sidebar. So February 2015, 6 months before his formal announcement, Cohen hired Gager to boost Trump in a Drudge Report poll on potential candidates. Trump ended up coming in fifth with 5% of the vote. My favorite, there are two of my favorite parts of this. The first is Cohen also asked Gager to create a Twitter account with the handle, and believe me, Opening Arguments is following this Twitter account now, at Women for Cohen, that would be run by a female friend of Gager's to portray Cohen as a sex symbol and hype his statements in favor of the Trump presidential campaign. And Women for Cohen is still up as of this recording. It may get taken down by then. It had under 1,000 people following it, even after this Wall Street Journal article was posted. Although we posted it on our Facebook account and we have, what, like 9,000 followers? So maybe it's up over 1,000 now. But under 1,000 at the time, followers of at Women for Cohen, with the description And again, I cannot make that. This is something Michael Cohen paid to have someone write about himself. Starting in May 2016, women who love and support Michael Cohen, strong pit bull, sex symbol, no nonsense, business oriented, and ready to make a difference. I don't have words for how delightful that is. So for 6 months, Women for Cohen tweeted nonsense about the Trump campaign that was followed by about 1,000 Russian bots and then nowhere else. That leads to the second best thing about this story, which is Gager says that he was to be paid $50,000 for his two unsuccessful efforts to rig the polls.
Yeah, I was going to say, for his incredible services rendered.
And for creating, I mean, look, like that Women for Cohen account, that's a $50,000 account.
That
right
took, yeah, 6 minutes of effort. If anybody, by the way, if anybody needs this done for them, I'm
yeah.
totally
oh,
yeah.
Do this, women for X, yeah, we will do it. Contact us, yeah. openargs@gmail.com.
50,000. You know what? We'll do it for 40.
Well, in order to undercut, again, what makes this delightful, Gager says, although he billed Trump $50,000, that shockingly, Donald Trump never paid the bill in full, that Michael Cohen gave him a blue Walmart bag with between $12,000 and $13,000 in cash. So, you know, yeah, again, we talked about this. This bookends the show rather nicely. Donald Trump stiffs people who works for him, including his dirty tricksters. Now, I don't know that I would stiff my dirty tricksters, although if they're as incompetent as Gager is.
No, what's next? You're going to find a CNBC poll that's like, who's the worst? And Donald Trump will still be not even in the top 100 because he can't manage it. He has no skill whatsoever.
Yep. So,
or he'll make a Twitter account. We don't like Michael Cohen. Like, what is he going to do? He can't...
at Michael Cohen is fat and not a sex symbol. Yeah. Oh man. So your delightful bit of Yodel Mountain insanity for this week.
That was good. That cheered us all up. That was fun. Good times. All right, it is time for our co-favorite segment of the week. And this is thanking our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And we begin with Rex Kirshner, Nate Drex, Hiram, Gustav Sundell, Leo Vortler, and you've got the rest, Andrew.
Yeah, and thank you to Eric. Thanks to Carl Blankenship, to our new top patron, although not really, and to Darren Dwyer. So short list this week. If you've ever thought about being an OA patron, now's a great time. Head on over to patreon.com/law. Throw us a buck. Come on. You listen to us on your commute. You listen to us every week. You know it's worth a dollar. But thank you so much to these folks for supporting the show, and we couldn't do it without you.
And we're coming fast upon another round of Patreon goodies toward the end of the month there, so good time to pledge.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, and now here we find out whether or not I've gone an improbable three-question streak. So here we go, TTTBE answer.
All right, this was a super short question about a dentist. Anesthetizing patient's jaw, sticks in a hypodermic needle. The needle breaks off in the patient's jaw, which sounds gruesome, because of a manufacturing defect that the dentist could not have detected. And the question also specified that the dentist used due care. So then the question is, when the patient sues the dentist on alleging Strix products liability and malpractice, is he likely to prevail? You eliminated down the answers to either no on either basis, that was A, or yes, based on strict products liability, but not on malpractice, which is C. And I want to tell you, Thomas's second chance bar exam is doing great, right? You eliminated yes, based on malpractice, but not based on strict products liability. No, there's obviously no malpractice here because it says in the fact pattern the dentist used due care, right? To prove malpractice, you must prove that the dentist departed from the professional standard of care. That also takes out D. So then the only question is strict liability. Well, you know, it says strict, right? you decided, notwithstanding the fact that it says strict liability, that doesn't seem to apply to the dentist. And I am happy to tell you that is correct. So A is the correct answer. Strict liability could apply on products liability if the dentist was selling the hypodermic needles, right? Like,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yep.
So it's not that products liability can never apply to somebody who's administering a service, but plainly here, it's not the dentist's fault, right? He's just using the needles, and it has a defect that he could not have detected, and he used due care in anesthetizing you. So, you know, let's libertarian paradise. Why? Let's small government. Why are you suing this guy? So we all agree.
Well, you should just sue the manufacturer.
Yeah, sue the manufacturer.
Right?
Of course, you sue the manufacturer here. So that is correct. So congratulations, 3-question winning streak, and.
What am I at? Because this is what question 110, so I would be 66 would be 60%, but I suspect I'm not quite there.
Thomas, you are at 64 out of 110. Oh. So close.
God, someday I'll hit that coveted
60%. Three more in a row, I think. I'm doing the math on the fly, but I think if you do 3 more in a row, you will get to 60%, that the coveted threshold.
Well, I'm not sure about that math, but someone who can find a TI-83 graphing calculator, I'm sure can figure that out for us. But thank you. Wow, I am honored by this 3-question streak. I'm deeply humbled, even though that's the opposite of what I really am. And I'd like you to hop in your limited use time machine, Andrew, and tell us who is this week's big lucky winner of TTTBE.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Hey, hey, it's Future Andrew here. Wait a minute. Why do I sound like Thomas? Oh my God, we have a time machine Freaky Friday situation. Okay. Oh, suck it up, Torres. You're a professional. You can do this. You can do this. Okay. Hi. No, that's stupid. Anyway, the winner this week in Thomas, I take the bar exam is Richard Marsh, who says, A, no recovery against the dentist under either theory. The dentist met the standard of care, so malpractice is out and strict liability doesn't attach because he's selling his dental services, not a product. Probably just hoping for that nuisance settlement. Congratulations, and everybody make sure to follow at REMarsh3 on Twitter. Okay, that's done. Google Freaky Friday Remedy. All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We will see you for a Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.